Aloha, and welcome to Goddess Alchemy and Divine Magic. I'm your cosmic guide and host, Charlotte Sivak, transmitting to you live from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. So we hope you've heard our beautiful intro, which is Shakti. It's by Patrick Bernard, and if you want to hear more about his gorgeous tracks and his music, please check him out at www.patrickbernard.com. We are really delighted to have you guys join us today for a really yummy, awakening, magical cosmic hour. We're going to be enjoying the nectar of life as we actualize heaven on earth, helping you to experience your vastness, expanding the collective consciousness, delving deep into the subconscious and past into the mysteries and phenomena, and all the while experiencing all the amazing synchronicities as we dare you to be the masterpiece that you were created to be. Now, today's fantastic wild card lineup, multidimensional, multi-layered show that we got for you, which you guys all know we plan moment to moment, we will do everything we can to definitely spark your creativity, infusing all of your infinite possibilities with the magical awakening of the divine child. So why don't we all let's just be daring and risk living in divine cosmic ecstasy. I just really enjoy doing this and being so honored to be able to bring on the amazing guests that we have and the incredible synchronicities that I find that happen every single time. I mean, just before we're coming onto the air, I can't tell you how many times I have somewhat of an idea of what I think is going to be happening. And then, of course, 5 minutes before the show, everything changes. And yet it always works out perfect. So that's why we just love the whole moment-to-moment. Just be, just totally be. Now, we are in a really incredible synchronistic day today, with it, of course, being there's so many intersecting things that are happening today, with, of course, it being the elections in the United States, Mercury retrograde beginning today, and, of course, the Saturn and the Scorpio alignment that has come into our field within the last 3 weeks, which is going to be around for the next 3 years. And our fantastic guest that is coming on in just a few minutes. But before we bring her on, I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. The synchronicities of this is just absolutely mind-blowing. She hosts her own fantastic radio show called Just Energy Radio. She is a best-selling author. She's a medical intuitive. She is also the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. She's the author of 3 books, as well as hundreds of articles that have been published worldwide, and she has appeared on radio and television and has spoken at conferences covering topics such as health and healing and ghosts and intuition, ancient mystery, and the paranormal. I mean, it's unbelievable. She is an absolute inspiration. She is completely here to help and to guide, and she herself, with her own radio show, Just Energy Radio, she has her own incredible caliber of guests and far-reaching topics that she reaches into. And it's just unbelievable, and we're just really honored to have her here today. Her name is Dr. Rita Louise. Want to give a big rounding hello and aloha to you for being on our show.
And hi, Charlotte. Oh, thanks for having me on.
Wow, you have one incredible resume. It's just fantastic, and it's such an amazing opportunity to have you on. And again, you really truly are an inspiration and a trailblazer, and that's just fantastic. Talk about being in divine orgasmic ecstasy your whole life, right?
Thank you. You know, people go, well, why do you do what you do? I go, I just do what they tell me.
That's, then they wonder. Well, that's pretty incredible. And again, too, today, with your new book that you have coming out, The Man-Made, The Chronicles of the Extraterrestrial Gods, which we're going to be talking quite a little bit about in a few minutes. But before we do that, I want to make sure everybody has your website, which is www.soulhealer.com, and you also have the WWW Just Energy Radio, and, of course, the man-made thechronicles.com. So you can please go right ahead and check out her website. She's got some incredible things that she's offering and classes and workshops and inspirational speaking. And, of course, all the books that she has as well, too. So with today, you being on and this topic of extraterrestrials and the government elections today and all this, it's just a really incredible synchronicity.
Good. Well, I'm not quite sure how the election and extraterrestrials fit together unless you start getting into the very conspiracy theory part of, are the extraterrestrials still controlling what's going on the planet, which is definitely a possibility. My book doesn't focus on that topic, but it's one that we can explore if you want to.
That would be wonderful. I was, just before we got you to come on the air, I was just doing whatever, my preparation things that I do before a show, and a few of my guides showed up, and they literally tossed one of my books by Dr. Joshua David Stone across the living room, and of course it opened straight to the page, and it was a meditation activation on connecting to the consciousness of humanity with the extraterrestrials to prepare an open dialogue. So as I was looking through it, it was mentioning about how for us to help to get in connected with the Confederation of Planets and to allow everybody and the light workers to open up. But what was so interesting was throughout the aspect of the meditation, it was talking about how we were asking for help also in our election of our governmental officials to also be coming in who would be able to hold the vision of entering into politics with light workers for the United States and for the countries around the world. And I thought, oh, that's unbelievable, of course. Here we go again, synchronicity. So it's mind-blowing. And, of course, today with it being Mercury retrograde and meaning our communication system, there might be challenges. And, of course, now all of a sudden there's all this noise happening here. Communication interruptions, computers blowing up and dematerializing. Plans messed up. We'll see how this is going to be affecting also the election race today. But also, what I'm really thinking is amazing is this whole Scorpio and Saturn alignment, which just came in about 3 weeks ago, which is also about opening up, going through the veils, seeing more of the secret hidden stuff, and whatever government cover-ups, not necessarily always being about conspiracy theorists, but also how synchronistic that your book, which is about ancient secrets and stories, bringing together the myths of all the cultures, would come out at this time as well, too. So it's totally in divine order how even the planets align for your book to be brought forward at this time. It's incredible. So please, tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods, we surveyed myths from around the world, and I know that that probably sounds really boring to most people, but where we got started, we were watching shows on 2012 on TV, and one of the things they would say is, you know, well, this is what they say in the Mayan tradition, in the five cycles, in the end of the fifth cycle, and blah, 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 and then they would go on to say, well, in Egypt, they agree with this, and in the Hindu tradition, they have similar legends, but they wouldn't say what the Hindu legends were or the Native American legends were, which got me on this whole investigating 2012 thing, which is not the topic of our conversation, but that was kind of where all of this started. And one of the things that I uncovered in my investigation was a story from the Hindu tradition about Manu and the fish. And the story reads very similar to the story of Noah's Ark, which was intriguing to me. I had always known that, or had known for a long time, that there are, you know, 500 or 600 flood stories that have been recounted around the world. But the assumption that I made, and I think that most people make, is that the flood stories are going to be different. For example, if my toilet overflows in my house and your hot water heater blows up in your house, and then we just had this big storm on the East Coast and we had the tsunami in Indonesia, they're all flood stories. And
if I could just add to that, they are actually shooting the movie Noah's Ark in New York City, which had to stop production with Russell Crowe because of Sandy. I mean, come on.
That's a thing. Well, maybe they should just have done some. Well, I guess they got some really good stock footage, you know?
Yeah. Before they evacuated the set.
That's right. Just leave that camera running. I'm sure it'll all be good. But you would think that if I had a flood and you had a flood and they have a flood there, that these stories would all be different. But that's not what we found. What we found was, in essence, the number of different narratives were extremely finite. For example, in the flood story, it says that a righteous or virtuous or pious man is warned about an impending flood. He builds an ark, he builds a boat, he builds a canoe, he climbs on a leaf, maybe climbs a tree, or climbs to the top of a mountain, and he and his wife, or he and his sister, or he and, you know, some other adult family members, and maybe some children are saved from the devastation. Some of the stories include animals either being on the boat with him or climbing to the top of the mountain. A few stories actually add in the element of them releasing a bird out to let them know that dry land appears. Charlotte, that is encompassing every myth story we found on the planet.
Incredible.
And it blew our mind. It blew my mind. And so I thought, you know, the flood story in the big picture of things is so far back in time. You know, it's so far in time that what we really need to do is to go back to, you know, I like to say, quote unquote, in the beginning, and then move forward. Because if we're finding this kind of parallel with the flood story, what are we going to find when we go back to the beginning of time and move forward? And we found corollaries between mythology from around the world that I use the flood story because most people are very familiar with it. But we found the same kind of parallels through mythology moving through time. And what we ended up with, and this is kind of a visual, was like this giant Excel spreadsheet where in the beginning was at the top and the flood story was, you know, way down at the bottom. And we took these myths and started placing them into this Excel spreadsheet, and we came up with a timeline. We allowed the myth to unfold a timeline. And this person has this little detail here. Well, this culture didn't really talk about it much, or there's just a one-line piece to it. But it gives you a much deeper understanding of the subtleties of our history. But a story that is consistent throughout humanity on the planet.
It sounds incredible. And I see here, too, how you were mentioning about how you, or with mythology also being filled with the stories of romances and all this elaborate and intricate plots, how it can also expand into so many different levels. So you must have been just spinning as you were putting this all together.
I love the word you chose. I would often comment that I felt like a slot machine waiting for the 777 to come up because I'd have these myths floating around in my head going, okay, this one goes with this, but what about this? Well, no, not quite yet, you know, and I'm waiting for that 777 to appear so I could write down these are the correlating myths.
So which one was your favorite one, or which one was the one that, I mean, I'm sure there was more than one, but that really stood out for you?
I think one of my favorite ones is a story that comes out of India, and it's a very famous story, not that we hear about it in the Western world, but in India, it's a very famous story, and it's called The Churning of the Milky Ocean, and in this story, the gods are living on a watery world. And they are in search of their precious thing that had been lost, and it is Amrita, the nectar of immortality. And so there are two basic groups of gods that they talk about. I mean, they have four pantheons, but they were split into two groups, the devas, who were the good gods, And then the Asuras, who are the are portrayed as being the evil gods. And so they made an alliance that they were going to work together to get this Amrita from below the surface of the water. And so they took Mount Madeira, and they used that as this drilling rig. I mean, it's the only thing I can liken it to. And they took this giant snake, the king of the Nagas, and wound him around the mountain, and they pulled on either side of the snake and used the mountain to drill down or to go down into the water. Well, after thousands and thousands of years, and there's a bunch of story that kind of goes in between this whole thing, a number of things come out of the water, and one of them is their precious Amrita. So that part of the story is pretty interesting. But then it gets even juicier. And so, I mean, these gods,
always
you know,
good.
Well, you know, our impression of the gods is that, you know, they're kind and benevolent. That's not what we find in mythology. So the devas, the good gods, their plan, they really weren't ever going to share the nectar of immortality with the Asuras, because it would mean that the Asuras could be as strong or stronger than the devas. And so the devas pray to Vishnu, their supreme god, to help them so that the Asuras, the bad gods, don't get the Amrita. And so Vishnu transforms himself into a desirous-looking woman and goes to the Asuras and distracts them from their pursuit of the Amrita. And in the meantime, all the devas are drinking it. So that by the time, yeah, and so by the time the Asuras realize what's going on, it's gone. And obviously war breaks out, and that starts this whole flare of activities between them.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. You know, I just laugh. One little comment, then I'll hush. My favorite part of the whole story is that the divas are the good gods, but they're the biggest connivers of them all.
That was actually going to be my next question. Yeah, so it just goes to show you, wow, spinning teacup ride or what?
Mm-hmm.
Incredible. So with your book, so again, Man-Made, The Chronicles of the Extraterrestrial Gods, we are on the air with Dr. Rita Louise, and which, you know, I don't usually ask this question, but I need to. How did you end it?
We ended the book not much after the flood. The flood story. You know, we brought in a lot of science and archaeology into the narrative because there are myths that suggest time, and we looked at the rise of humanity as part of it. And so we ended the book at the point where mankind had created or we had civilization, because with civilization, we had the ability to write. And with the ability to document our lives, you know, our mythology could be written down. And so we decided to end there because bringing it into a more contemporary light, or bringing in concepts that come out of modern day UFO culture, we felt would take away from the point and impact that we felt our narrative would have.
Now, say, for example, you have all these readers, it becomes, and let's hope that it's going to become a great cult hit as well, too, and they want to go and visit some of these archaeological sites. Would you have, like, maybe here's your next book, writing on the tour of the mythology or the archaeological sites of the mythology?
I mean, we did not bring in any archaeology. We brought more information in, you know, because the majority of the archaeology that at least that contemporary archaeologists and scientists say is really in the sort of last chapter of the book, the building of the pyramids, the rise of the civilization in Sumer, the culture in India, that all occurred somewhere between, and I'm going to say 4,000 and 2,600 B.C.
Quite a while ago.
Well, it's quite a while ago, but in relationship to the storyline in the book, it's kind of like the period at the end of the sentence. Because when you look at mythology, mankind is just the footnote on the story. Mankind doesn't come into the story until like the second to last chapter.
How incredible. And I was thinking of how, with just regards to where some of these had taken place, even from a scientific perspective, say if someone was interested to go and see it, just to even see if they can feel the vibration of it or pick it up from the rocks or the area that's there, and you know, the, or the frequency, and be able to discern some of this as well, too.
Well, you know, I have a very good friend named Brian Forrester, who is one of the key people working on the elongated heads in South America. And he and I have had conversations, and we didn't talk about this in the book, but there are a number of locations around the world that are called the center of the earth. You know, like Delphi, they had the Omphalos, you know, and it was the center of the earth. In Cusco, in South America, it is the center of the earth. On Easter Island, the center of the earth. I think in Egypt, it's also considered the center of the earth. And I think places that have that connotation associated with these very specific locations would be the place. If I was going to pick somewhere, that's where I would pick.
Well, this is fascinating. And for all of you out there who are into visiting sacred sites or trying to, you know, explore and find your own sites, this sounds like it could be a fabulous book for you to pick up and just allow it to just speak to you. It's so incredible. So it sounds like you had quite an amazing time with this whole process of actually even putting this book together.
We did. I mean, I have a co-author, Wayne LaLiberty, who's my husband, so it made it so much easier. And
now, how many hours did her? When were you not sleeping?
Yeah, pretty much.
You guys must have been up for a long time.
Well, and just talking and talking, because we would uncover a piece of information. You go into any writing project or anything like this with your beliefs. And as we researched, we found that we kept hitting our own beliefs and saying, well, maybe we need to take this notion and put it to the side. And maybe we need to take this notion and put it to the side. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the writings of Zachariah Sitchin.
I'm not sure. Can we give a little background on that?
I mean, he's written a number of books that talk about our history, and he is has translated the Sumerian text, and you know, Zachariah Sitchin, S-I-T-C-H-I-N, Sitchin, yeah.
And you can Google that and get more information.
Right.
On him.
I mean, you know, and his books I found very compelling. You know, but when we wrote this, we, again, put his material to the side. We put the Bible to the side, because what
if
it's
not true? And what did you find out of the Bible that really, I know you said you put it to the side, but what sparked from there?
Well, what was interesting is that after we had the majority of our narrative done, we found that a number of the stories that came down through mythology were recounted in the Bible.
Incredible.
You know, the names are changed. We don't have multiple gods. We just have one God. I think the biggest one where, you know, I'm kind of waiting for the little slammy feedback, is I believe that the Book of Revelation, as opposed to being a prophecy of what is to come, is actually the retelling of a story, actually specifically out of Greek mythology, although that storyline travels around the world, with the understanding of the author saying, if you don't surrender to the will of God, then this can happen to you, not this will happen to you. And he recounts an ancient story with a lot of angels flying around and, you know, snakes and dragons. But in many other mythologies, the gods are referred to as snakes and dragons and beasts and, you know, the Asuras, the bad gods in India, are often referred to in a snake form or a monster form or in some kind of a beast form. And so it didn't really even fall out of the genre of ancient mythology.
Unbelievable. That must have led to some interesting dreams as well.
Thank God I'm not a dreamer. but it has come to, you know, we have played around with the idea, you know, if I was a screenwriter, that this storyline would make for a very interesting science fiction plot line, because it's just, it's really compelling. You know, and there'd be lots of wars and lots of special effects, and they had these great weapons. I mean, the gods had great weapons that, you know, shot out like laser beams and did all kinds of stuff that would just, you know, be made for a visual
infinite
audience.
Possibilities. Let's put it
That's
out there.
Right. Yeah.
We'll have to bring you back when you're ready to go to your premiere for your movie.
That's right. My red carpet.
Red carpet. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's how it usually starts, right? So mm-hmm. It's and sparking the not just the intelligence, but also that creative energy, which is really incredible. Now, what about, was there any symbols that came out of it, or any type of sacred geometry or symbology that was really stood out to you, too, that you were working with when you were writing the book or doing your research?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we looked at, not so much as visual symbology,
mm-hmm.
but more in the symbology of how individuals were related. I mean, that was one of the things that we really focused on. So if a god was identified as being a trickster, that persona was usually tied to a certain category, so then you could kind of put names and tie storylines. But there was one symbol in particular, there was one that came out of this whole thing that I found fascinating, which so I put it in the book. And that is a symbol that comes out of Chinese script. And it is the symbol for heaven, and it's called Tain. And the symbol, you know, so when we think of heaven, you know, the place where God lives.
Right.
But this symbol, instead of looking like, I don't know, a cloud, I mean, I don't even know how you would represent in pictures heaven.
And actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because only a few months ago, I was reading through my own research, and what I was seeing was they were seeing the number 8, also too looking like infinity, represented the numerological symbology for heaven. So that's interesting.
I'm going to come back to that. That's very interesting. I've not heard that. And see, now I'm going to have to, I've already told my husband we need to write an revised and expanded edition of this book. because people, you know, the more I talk about it, I have been getting feedback of things that I hadn't heard, I had not been led to go research.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to come back to that, because I have a thing to say.
Oh, please.
Okay, so I'm writing that down so I come back.
Oh, okay.
But the symbol for heaven, what it looks like is a giant person. And so the word Tain is one of the oldest Chinese terms for the cosmos. And so the earliest inscription of the word is represented by what appears to be a humanoid form with outstretched arms denoting great or large. The cranium of this person is also emphasized. And so the thought we had, you know, we didn't say, well, this is it, but the thought we had was, could the original meaning for heaven not be talking about the location, but actually be talking about the deities who live in heaven?
That's interesting.
But now I'm going to come back to your 8 thing, because I find that very interesting. When you look at the progenitor gods, the original gods who we believe were the extraterrestrials who came and habitated and manipulated this world. Mythology says, and this is a pretty constant number that comes up, is that there were 8 gods, 4 matched pairs. You know, so there was a male-female matched pair.
Interesting.
Some say that they were hermaphroditic, you know, so mm-hmm. that they had male and female essence, kind of like the yin-yang.
Mm-hmm.
Some say there were 8 individuals. We don't really know. But they were always identified as day and night, or earth and sky, you know, and so there was always this balance and harmony between these two aspects, but there were 4, you know, of these dual pairs, which made 8 total. And so I think it's interesting that you're making this comment to heaven, because it even reflects that symbol of, well, maybe we're not talking about heaven, but instead the deities who live there.
So then what are your feelings about this comment where we're all saying about creating heaven on earth, bringing heaven here, anchoring it here, so above, so below? How would that pertain to this?
You might not like my answer.
No, that's, hey, we're all open here. Let's,
you know, people ask, what were the gods like? You know, that's, I think, a curiosity factor. For many people, what were they like?
Absolutely.
And my response to them is all we need to do is look at who we are, the culture that we've created, the values and morals that we have, and they actually are an expression of the gods.
Totally makes sense. Reflection.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. And it's so true, as they say, too. We heal the world one person at a time by healing ourselves, taking responsibility and ownership for what we see that is reflected within our environments, because, of course, that is also reflecting what's going on within us. So how would this also bring you into the oneness consciousness? How does that also pertain with mythology or with all the research that you did?
Well, I think one of the things that we were hoping to achieve, you know, and this wasn't like we had the intention of doing this, but we feel that this is going to be part of the outcome,
right,
is to help open people's minds up to other possibilities, other levels of reality. You know, there is the belief that, you know, everything that's in our world centers around the words that are in the Bible. And not to invalidate the Bible at all, but I think that there's a much bigger world that we don't take into account. You know, and
I couldn't agree with you more on that.
You know, and one of the things that I firmly believe, even though it's really not reflected in the book, is that many of the ancient traditions, which I would include mythology, you know, are written on multiple levels. They come to us on multiple levels. And so while we are talking about the physical presence and the physical interaction with these gods, it doesn't take away from there being other levels of communication that are being presented to us through them.
Well, that's amazing. And then what about with the dimensions? And some people refer them to as spheres, others dimensions. I mean, even too with Barbara Hand Cloud, how she's writing about the alchemy of 9 dimensions. How did that have any spark, any significance too with this, with all the research that you did?
One of the things that we could not make a conclusion on, and so we chose not to include it, other than like one little teeny paragraph. I mean, we did address it.
Will this be in the revised copy?
I don't think so. I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. I mean, we addressed it in one little part.
Mm-hmm.
It is impossible, based on mythology, to determine whether these beings were physical in nature, whether they were spiritual in nature, but I'm going to make a caveat on that, or if they were some kind of a multidimensional being that would come and manifest into this physical realm. It does seem clear, however, that ancient cultures were able to discern the difference between a ghost and the gods. And so they could tell that they were different. You know, and
how
so
incredible.
And so there wasn't, you know, this ethereal property to them.
Now, with all the legends and the heaven and everything that came up through the research that you did and what you discovered, what about the planets? What about anything? Was there anything related with the solar system, the universe, or anything related to maybe where one of the deities or the gods maybe came from, like, say, for example, Venus or from Mars?
Are you reading my mind?
I must be psychic.
I mean, one of the things that we, you know, I'm going to say conclude, maybe a better word would be speculate.
Okay.
Is that these gods, you know, the eight that we were talking about,
right,
actually came to the solar system and first tried to colonize Mars. In the mythology, it talks about them basically setting up shop on a dark world or a not fully lit world. And they're there, and, I mean, we make some arguments geologically about how it could possibly be Mars with timeline-wise.
Too, how they had the pyramids that they said is also on Mars, so maybe there's some correlation there.
Well, and that was kind of why I felt like the Earth wasn't the original location, and they had been somewhere before.
Right.
So we were just goofing around and saying, well, maybe it's Mars. You know, they got those pyramids there. But when we started researching the scientific aspects of Mars going back to the date we felt they arrived, which was 4.5 billion years ago, there were a number of coincidences and synchronicities that became very compelling to us to actually put Mars as part of the story. One of the things that we found was NASA scientists have identified that within 2 million years of the formation of Mars, it had the best chance of becoming an Earth-like planet than ever. But one of the things, and that's 2 million years, and they couldn't figure out how in 2 million years Mars could be covered with water and start having some kind of organic life growing on it. You know, or if it was going, this is how they say, you know, if it was going to have organic life, it would have been during this period. You know, they got to hedge those bets.
Well, this is just so fascinating. I mean, it's just, you can go into so many areas. It's just mind-boggling. So I can only imagine you must have felt like you were, like, taking some kind of euphoric drug or something while you were doing
it. It definitely had its moments. You know, and actually a good friend of mine, Ken Gearhart, has a radio show, but he's a cryptozoologist. And so I'm like, hey, Ken, have me on your show. You know, but he's really good about sticking to cryptozoology. You know, I mean, that's his show. And so we were talking about the giants and some of the other creatures.
Can I just ask, sorry to interrupt you, but what, just for those listening, what is zookeeper cryptology? I said it totally wrong. Sorry, Ken.
Oh, I'm liking you more and more every minute, Charlotte. Cryptozoology.
Okay.
And so cryptozoologists, so the people who study cryptozoology, are the ones that study, like, Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. You know, so the creatures that come out of myth and legend that we don't have any physical proof of yet.
Yet.
I like the yet part.
Yes, love the yet.
And so we started talking about Bigfoot, you know, because that's a crypto thing. And the possibility that there were parallels between contemporary Bigfoot and the stories of giants that come out of mythology. And one of the things that cryptozoologists talk about is that Bigfoot is usually found in the mountains. You know, we find them in the Pacific Northwest that is very mountainous. And we find them in the, I think, more like the Appalachian Mountains, which is kind of southeast United States. But they're traditionally associated with mountainous and definitely wooded areas. And in mythology, the giants were always associated with mountains and wooded areas and also caves. And they were also, I'm going to say nocturnal. They were the children of the moon. And so, you know, by the end of this interview that I had with him, his whole head was spinning because he's like, dang. You know, and even though we didn't address it specifically, you know, you could take this information and apply it to a lot of different areas of contemporary research. You know, cryptozoology, modern ufology, again, which we did not cover specifically in the book, but there are ties and correlations that run into both of those areas.
Well, this is mind-bending, and I love it. And it's, you know, it also reminds me so much of how much I love alchemy, because it is about merging, where we bring together the whole spirituality, the science, and everything, because I'm sure there's also places or dimensions in this world or galaxy or whatever you want to call it where that already has happened. And with us, too, and, you know, of course, well, we might as well throw the question out now, too, with this being 2012 as well. Did you find any type of correlation to that through all your research as well?
Not specifically. Well, I mean, it's kind of a yes or no question.
Right.
This is one thing that I did find that ties to 2012, and I've tried doing research on it, and I'm not finding any answers. So if any of your listeners can point me in a direction, I would love it. One of the things that I found, well, it kind of blew me away, and I just left it as an open-ended question in the book because I wasn't finding anything hard. I wasn't finding any archaeological records or anything to support this. However, so according to, and we're just going to take the December 21st, 2012 date. I don't agree with it personally, but we're just going to use that for
sure. Sounds
talking
good.
Point. Okay, so the, you know, that cycle is supposed to last for, and I'm like pulling this right out of memory, 5,126 years.
Years.
And so going back in time, that takes you to August 3,114 BC. And when you look at Mayan cosmology, that date, whatever, you know, and a, you know, whatever that Mayan date is, well, we won't say the American date, but that 3,114 BC
okay.
is associated with creation or a level of creation. And there's a myth that is found around the country, you know, on the stela carved into stones that talk about the planting of the three hearth stones. So I thought that was pretty interesting. I mean, I have been doing presentations on 2012 and look, you know, talking about the mythology about 2012, so I have a lot of information. Anyway, so there's that piece. In the Hindu tradition, we have moved into what is called the Kali Yuga. It is the end of their four-world cycle. Now, we ended the third world and moved into the fourth world in 3,110 BC. All right, now we're talking about, based on the December 21st date, a 14-year difference. You know, and I think that, is, there's a lot of room for plus or minus in there.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty interesting. But then we add in another one. In Judaism, their creation date is 3,763 BC. Please don't anybody quote me on that, but it's pretty close.
Well, so they're not buying a car, so I don't think it's going to be a problem.
You know, because they have never changed their calendar, so right now we are at 5,000-something-something-something. You know, not A.D. or B.C., it's just 5,000, because all of their chronology starts from the date of creation. But that still puts us into that 3,000-something. But their story is also a story of creation. The problem is that we don't know what was happening before, because we know something was going on before, obviously, that we had a new beginning, a new start. And that's the piece that I'm looking for that I'm having a problem finding, is what transpired to make people documented. I've said that, you know, I've said, well, we don't know. And they go, oh, well, that's when civilization rose. And it's like, I'm going to write on my calendar, civilization started today. I don't think so. So there has to be something, some event that happened that made people document it, that there was a new beginning. But what that event was, whether it was a meteor or what, you know, what that was, I don't know. Can't
you made me think of Barbara Hand Cloud in Catastrophobia, where she's writing about how that was the last creation, how I believe it was also too, where the world was hit by a meteor or something. I can't exactly remember what it was, but how it has also traumatized, in essence, our race as well. It's, but again, like you said, there's so many different stories, and not to mention how they say too, where there's wars over lands, and they would go in and basically destroy whatever records were left and then create their own and say, well, let's just start today. So you were just making me think of the scrolls as well, too, in Alexandria, where I believe they said they kept them. But there's
scrolls. That's just such a sad state of affair that, you know, all of those scrolls and all of those records were destroyed. It's right up there with all of the Mayan records and Aztecs records that were destroyed when the conquistadors came here and burned everything.
Right. But they said, too, as also a lot of that was also given through word of mouth as well, too. So,
well, one of the things that comes to us through mythology is that the stories of our history and the stories of mankind were actually given to us by the gods. And one of the conclusions that I feel very strongly with, that I did make, was that the stories that we have in mythology are not our stories about the gods, but the gods' stories about themselves. Because when you read the myth, it's talking about, hey, me and Charlotte, we were doing this stuff, and then, you know, we went to 7-Eleven, and, you know, got a big gulp, and we were hanging out. and mankind in these stories is, you know, they live in the mountainous area, and they're doing the mining, and they're, you know, they're in this subservient role, kind of like we were a plantation owner, and these were our workers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we were the ones writing the stories about the gods, one, would we write such nasty things about them? and two, would we write about ourselves in such a diminutive posture?
I can just see people 5,000 years from now dissecting the big gulp. What is that? That must have been such an experience that levitated people.
Well, you know, they're going to find those plastic cups, and they're going to go, it's for ritualistic purposes.
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Well, Dr. Rita, it's been so fantastic having you on the show and to delve into such an incredible, vast amount of knowledge and experience. And again, once again, for everyone listening, we are with Dr. Rita Louise. She is the best-selling author, medical intuitive, and host of Just Energy Radio and the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. You can find her at www.soulhealer.com and also at, yeah, you have a few websites, justenergyradio.com, where she also has her own incredible guests on and everything. We've been talking about her brand-new book that's out. Where can people find it if they want to run out to the store and get it immediately?
I mean, it is available online at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. They can also purchase it either at the soulhealer.com website or the manmadethechronicles.com website. If they order from the Soul Healer site or the Manmade the Chronicle site, they would come directly from us. And you know, since they come directly from us, they would all come signed. Where the
No signatures.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Is there any events that you have coming up in the coming weeks that you would like to also mention while we're on that note?
Sure. I actually have a number of different things coming up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area if you are in Texas. This weekend I will be speaking at the Metaphysical Way, talking about the book. I'm doing a lot of talking about the book. then I will be at Epic, which is in Grapevine, doing a presentation on Myth as History. I will be doing a similar presentation for Dallas MUFON. You know, it's getting close to the holidays, so that's kind of the end of this year's activities. And then there's, you know, then it'll be picking back up after the first of the year.
Right.
Well, you know how it is. You hit Thanksgiving, and it's like,
yeah, we have Thanksgiving in Canada in October, so.
Oh, that's right. You're Canadian.
So we've already passed it. But, what we could say is you have a newsletter, right? So you want to know more and stay in touch with Dr. Rita, please visit her website and sign up for her newsletter at www.soulhealer.com. And once again, thank you so much for this fascinating chronicles of man-made of the extraterrestrial gods. It was absolutely fabulous. We were so inspired and really great to have you on. Thank you so much.
Oh,
and we want to thank you.
Charlotte.
Oh, it's been wonderful. And we want to thank you all, too, for tuning in and listening in. And for those of you in the Toronto area, I'm going to be at the Whole Life Expo this weekend at the Metro Toronto Convention Center doing a presentation speaking about the divine mission of animals, as well as Wolfstock next week at the Direct Energy Center in Toronto, for those of you that are around. And our next show, which will be on November 20th, we're going to be welcoming the father and son team of the new Hay House book, Empowering Youth, Jeffrey and Michael Eisen. So it should be fabulous. So we look forward to speaking with them as well. And once again, we thank you so much, Dr. Rita Louise. And aloha blessings to everybody who listened in.